Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Dr. Jack Justin Turner, Professor Emeritus of International Relations at MTSU, is back with another historical novel based in the mountains of Kentucky. It's called The Foxes and the Hounds, Volume 1, Big Medicine River Days, from Chestnut Hill Publishing, and he'll be talking about it at MTSU on November 10th. He'll also be talking about it at the 2008 Kentucky Book Fair in Frankfort, Kentucky, on November the 15th. We're going to talk about it now because we have Dr. Turner on the phone from here in Murfreesboro, where he is known to spend time occasionally. Welcome back, Jack.
Well, thank you, Gina. I'm glad to be back.
This novel follows the adventures of a couple of locals in the Kentucky Mountains called Adrian Galt and Lawton Herold. But before we get into what they do in this book, I want to ask you about the photo on page 5, which I suppose purports to depict Adrian and Lawton. But since this is a fictional work, who are those guys and what is the story behind that photo?
Well, what happened was when I was writing the prologue, I had in mind what the two main characters looked like, and it was the photo corresponded to it, sort of, and so I just, they're relatives. They're not the real people it's based on. It's just that they fit. It was sort of strange the way it worked out, that, and so I used it, and I'll try to find another one for the next part. But.
Did you have to use, Adobe Photoshop to manipulate the photo in any way, or is that the real deal?
That's the real deal. I think the publisher had some trouble getting it as clear as he would have liked to have, but it turned out it's good enough. It's not quite as good as the original.
Both of these real-life gentlemen are deceased, I take it?
Yeah, just about everybody in this book is deceased.
These guys, the fictional guys, Adrian and Lawton, leave home and they go to the outside to attend school. Lawton wants to be a lawyer. Adrian wants to be a school teacher. Is Corinth College, which they both attend, based on any institution of higher learning in particular?
Well, I quite often get that question, and I don't think it is. It's probably a combination of two or three that I was familiar with. It may be located around Ashland, Kentucky. It's about as much as I can tell you about it.
How much of MTSU, if any, is in Corinth College?
Well, I think some. I hadn't thought about that before, but some of the colleagues I had are probably in there disguised. I'm not sure which ones, but I think that's probably correct.
How would you describe the college? Is it like a small liberal arts school?
It was a small liberal arts school, and it was unusual for its time because it had both men and women, and of course they weren't allowed actually to talk to each other or anything else, but at least had them both in the college. And it may have something to do with Oberlin, which you may be familiar with, or Berea College, which were similar in a way.
And Berea is in Kentucky, I know.
Yeah, and Oberlin's in Ohio, and they're both small liberal arts colleges that had a religious basis, but at the same time they were ahead of their time in lots of ways.
One of these boys in particular, Adrian, it seems to me, gets, as the old expression goes, way above his raisin in a bad way. Can you explain without giving away the ending of Volume 1?
Well, the two boys are based on two actual men from Paintsville, Kentucky. I don't want to get too detailed, I guess. And one of them's name is Isaac Redmond Turner, a relative, and the other is John C.C. Mayo, who's a well-known capitalist in that part of the world. And the reason I focused on them is because they were native mountaineers. The story in Kentucky, and a source of a lot of trouble they have there, is that the outsiders came in and bought up all the mineral rights and sort of robbed the country. And that's not far from the truth, but in this case, there are two young men from the mountains. And one of them, Isaac Redmond Turner, I particularly liked him because he fought the Civil War, and he ended up in Boston. He fought for the Union, and while he was up there, he married a local socialite and went to Harvard Medical School, and he told her that Eastern Kentucky is the most beautiful place on earth, and he took her back with him, and she wouldn't stay but about 3 or 4 months, and she'd get on the steamboat and go back home, and then she'd come back in a month or two, so it's I thought that was pretty interesting.
And what particular kin is Isaac Turner to you?
I've been trying to find out. It's difficult to find out for some reason. I know we're kin because I'm kin to all the Turners up there. So, but I haven't been able to. I know that he was a hero of a typhoid epidemic on the little creek where I grew up, and right around the turn of the century. But it's something I'm trying to find.
Did the real-life people on whom these guys are based have as much difficulty dealing with the outside as these guys do?
They probably had more, really. When you look at Kentucky, there are a lot of poor people at that time. We're talking about the turn of the century. But there are also landowning people that live rather well. And I don't think in this particular part of Kentucky, which is based on the Big Sandy region, that they would have sold their mineral rights so cheaply if it hadn't been that the two locals who they trusted were buying them. So, in a way, it's a tragedy, but I don't know that these two have never been able to decide, since one of them died early, what their true intentions would have been in the long run.
The area that Lawton and Adrian are leaving in the book is... as we explained in the sheriff's murder cases, when we talked about that on a prior radio show, has sort of been inundated with Yankee businesses interested in grabbing all the wealth they can by mining the local natural resources. But in the front of the book, there's this fellow named Americus, who is a former senator and governor, who says, "The Northerners duped no one. They weren't capable of it. We duped ourselves." Do you agree with Americus?
I think in Appalachia in general, I wouldn't say that, but for the Big Sandy region, I believe that the two men, and I don't want to get in trouble with their relatives, but I guess it's too late, that without these two men, it would not have happened the way it did. The people there were pretty well off compared to most of Appalachia and pretty shrewd, and I just don't think they would have sold their mineral rights to this whoever came along. So they played a crucial role, and I've often wondered, and we'll never know, of course, how it would have turned out if one of the main characters that owned most of the mineral rights had not died early. He died in 1916 before it got nearly as developed as it was later.
But even so, it's not as though the moral of this novel is, as Dorothy would say, there's no place like home.
No, it's not that so much as when the outsiders came in, instead of, I think you and I talked about Detroit one time, but it's not like they came in and joined the community and tried to improve things. What they did is they built coal camps, which were isolated from everything else in the local area, and they used their own money called scrip. You familiar
mm-hmm.
with that?
Yeah.
And so that meant that as far as the people who lived there before, they had no financial interaction with them. They just issued scrip, and then they took it back at the fabled company store, and that meant that they really weren't doing anything much for the local community at all. They didn't want to pay taxes that amounted to anything. And generally, it's sometimes referred to, I saw a good description of this somewhere, it was called a mineral colony.
And how would you describe, like, it's like a company town without a town, in essence. The town and the company are separate but interdependent.
Yeah, the company owned everything. They owned all the houses, if you could call them houses. They were shacks that were just put up to up the side of the mountain mostly, and they had their own police, which was always a problem, and they operated by pitting the different nationality groups against each other, so that there's a lot of hostility within the camp itself. And you're also dealing with a population that they took straight off the boat. It's not like they recruited the local mountaineers that might want to work in the mines.
Yeah,
they got people off it, put them in cattle cars, and delivered them up into the coal camp, and then put them in a shack and put them to work. And a lot of those miners wouldn't see the light of day for weeks.
But in this novel, towards the end, some of the locals form a local improvement association. And it sort of reminds me of an episode, an old episode of Law and Order, in which a man who is like the second husband of this woman kills the entire family, and the one of the attorneys says she feels sorry, you know, for the relatives who have to pick up the pieces, and the DA essentially says, people like that don't just barge in, they're invited in. So it sounds like blaming the victim, but in a sense, don't you have to sort of be a willing participant in order to get hooked?
Oh, yes, I think you're right. Now, these two individuals, they courted the, particularly Adrian Galt, he's in the outside world a good part of the time talking to interests, economic interests that he thinks should be interested in the coal, and he brings them in. And in fact, in the next section, which is next volume called Bluegrass Days, he arranges a caravan of industrialists from outside and brings them up there in wagons and hires the chef out of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel to see if they got good food, and toured that country with them. So he's certainly culpable in that sense, but I don't think he intended to let them run everything,
mm-hmm.
which is the way it turned out.
It sort of makes it easier for the local folks to accept all of these dramatic changes if a couple of local boys they've known all their lives and whose families they've known all their lives, who leave home, make good, come back, if they're the ones who actually introduce all of these new changes rather than some stranger, right?
Oh, yeah, that was a key to it, and that's what I'm talking about in the prologue. If you go back and look at all these mineral deeds that were written in the valley at that time, and I haven't looked at all of them, but I've seen a great number of them, you'll see that these are the names that are on them. They bought them. And they bought them from their friends, and then they sold them to the industrialists eventually.
Well, when they're out in the outside, they find out that the asphalt jungle has all kinds of people who are self-directed and really unconcerned with community or a sense of community, and they really see opportunity in these two boys, don't they?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they do, and they try to use them, and it's kind of a contest to see who could use who. And I think I've said this before, but I think it might have turned out differently if one of the boys who owned most of them, and he's a grown man, but then if he hadn't passed away early, he died in the Waldorf Astoria Hotel with a large group of New York doctors standing around trying to save him. But his wife, of course, she just couldn't do the things that he could do, and she sort of gave it away, I think. I'm making jumping to some conclusions I'm not sure I can support because it's so much later there.
Yeah. But tell me about Maggio and Patrone. What about those guys?
Well, they're enforcers that are sent in there to get the money back that Adrian has managed to get away with. And they encounter, of course, a mountain. I guess you'd call him. I don't know exactly. I got to be fair to him. Rooster Clay Bosburn. He was a member of one of the dominant clans there, and every clan just about had somebody that looked out for the interests of the people. And a lot of times, this meant someone who's willing to use a pistol or whatever. And he of course they ran into him, and it's a new experience for him, and a final experience.
Well, the country boy who plays dumb and then shows that he's smarter than the Northerners is a familiar plot theme in a lot of literature, a lot of books, movies, and stuff. Sometimes the Northerners taking advantage, the city slickers taking advantage of the new country boy in town, is another plot twist. It seems like you've kind of interwoven them in this one book.
Yeah, I think Adrian, he's willing to do about anything to get what he feels like would be that he'd need to improve life in the mountains. And so he sort of sells himself out, but he's completely sold himself out, and I think if it had gone on a little longer, he would have turn back the other way. It's just something I don't know, except I can write fiction about it because of his early death.
Is your sense of Adrian that there's any altruism in him, even at the beginning? That there is it all ego and self-direction, or are there any altruistic motives about helping his people, or is it more nuanced than that?
Well, I think what happens to Adrian is he wants to do good, and he seeks out these people that he thinks can help, and he's betrayed repeatedly. He's betrayed by not only by some of the men that he relies on, but by the daughter of one of them, and this sort of changes his whole character and the way he looks at things. I don't think he's not evil intrinsically or anything like that, or even close. He responds to these terrible things that happen to him, and that makes him a tougher character than Lawton, who is, I guess, his alter ego in a way, the other young man. So.
You'd sort of think, before you get deeply into the book, that they would have actually have the opposite characteristics, because Adrian wants to be a school teacher, which is considered the less Machiavellian profession, and Lawton wants to be a lawyer, and we all know what people think of lawyers.
Yeah, that's very good and very accurate, but what happens, it's done that way to indicate how much Adrian has to change to be the way he is, and Lawton is just, he's steady, he continues to do what he sets out to do, and they are, of course, in the foreshadowing. You've got the mountain chase and capture game called Foxes and the Hounds, which is that's the overall title of the trilogy. And in that, of course, you can see their character, or I hope you can. A lot of people can read this and really enjoy it and not notice this, that one of them is a fox and the other is a hound. But that's just the way their innate characteristics, I think, are almost as important this book as the mineral rights controversy.
I think that the characters who embody the foxes and the characters who embody the hounds alternate back and forth, it seems to me, especially on the outside.
Well, they may a little bit, but of course you're only dealing with the first volume, if you followed all three of them, if you read all three of them, I think you would probably not see that as important as it seems at this point. I've noticed that if you look at the evil characters in there, it goes from only moderately evil to really evil, and that there are there are two or three groups that fit into that. You could almost, one of, if you make one of them a little better, he would be Lawton and so on, and one of them, or he would be Adrian, and one of them a little worse, and so that it works together.
The volume two, are you working on it now?
Volume two is Bluegrass Days. I don't know how familiar you are with Kentucky history, and I find that not many people are, even Kentuckians, but in this time period we're talking about, there's more material than you can imagine. For years I was deathly afraid while I was teaching school, trying to carry out my job, that I was not going to get it done, that somebody else would write it. But they haven't done it. This, in part two, and I hate, in a way, I'm getting into telling some parts of it, perhaps I shouldn't this early, but in the second part, of course, the Kentucky governor is slain. I don't know if you're familiar with that. And it sort of fits into that, and he's, without spending too much time on it, there's an election that's disputed, and one side decides that they're going to contest it, and they have a contested election, and they meet in Frankfort to argue about who the governor is, and one side goes up in the mountains and gets 17 train cars filled with mountaineers and brings them down there, and they invade the capital because they're not going to have the wrong one elected. And of course, and I don't know the answer to this, nobody does, but somebody shoots the governor-elect from the state house, one of the offices of one of the state officials, and kills him.
Oh, goody. Not only do we get into politics, we have a hillbilly coup d'etat.
Yeah, except they had promised them drinks. And
well, that'll make them mad right off the bat if you don't deliver.
They were awfully mad about that, and finally they had to go down and buy them all drinks. Now, the price of admission on this train was you either had to have a pistol or a rifle to get on the train. And so after a while, they were trying to figure out how to get them back out of the capital. Kind of an incredible period. And I wouldn't be talking about this except that part's it's all done, and it's I don't think anybody can catch up with me now, although they write about it, but they don't. I'm writing historical fiction, so I've got more leeway.
Yeah. So where do you when do you expect Volume 2 to be out?
Well, I've kind of, the publisher wants to build up some interest. This one, Big Medicine River Days, just stops, more or less, and people call me and are anxious to find out when the next one's going to be available, and some of them are mad.
Well, it stops on a kind of a cliffhanger note. It stops on sort of an oh my God moment.
Yeah, I know. What fellow said, he was reading along and feeling good, and then turned the page and fell off a cliff. So it's no more to read. And I think within probably a year, it's written. It's just that there's a lot of interest in this book, and publisher has to make money, so
yes,
he wants to write it as far as he can.
In the sheriff's murder cases, you had a collection of definitions at the back of the book to help people who were not familiar with the local lingo understand certain terms as they followed the story. But you didn't feel compelled to do that with this book. Why not?
Well, I just felt like I thought that since it goes into the bluegrass and into Colorado, I could not do the same thing for the bluegrass. I was born in the mountains and grew up there, and I can write about the mountains, maybe not as well as some people, but I can write about it in a way that most people can't now just because I've got some age on me. I taught in a one-room school, for example, so I got up a place called Bull Creek, if you believe that, when I was in college. And
I believe it.
That makes it easy for me to do the sections on Adrian when he's teaching school. And we lived across the Big Medicine River, Big Sandy River, and the tornado took out the bridge. And for about 3 years, I was a boatman. I would have to carry him. I'd take my mother across, my father across the river to get to work. And so I'm pretty familiar with the way that worked. And I've even been, one of the most unusual situations for me is I was in a sort of a feud as a boy. Two of my friends who were turners, their father had been killed in a coal camp, caught foul, Dad said, which I don't know what that means, but I think you can guess.
Yeah.
Could have been anything. And they would come and get me when I was about 9 or 10, and we'd go up the mountain and get on top and then come down near the side, and the coal camp was below us. And we would throw rocks at the coal camp about half a day, just as hard as we could. And after a while, they'd come up the hill and try to catch us, but they'd get me one by an arm since I was younger, and we'd run and hide on the other side.
I'm surprised they didn't try to shoot you.
Well, they might have. I don't know why they did. Looking back, I didn't think that was too bright on my part, but I just went along and threw rocks the best I could. So, and, of course, I had lots of other experiences. I've been to a sorghum mill, just about anything in there I've had first-hand experience with. So I don't know. I don't know how they're going to catch up with me on this first part because they're all gone.
Well, I don't know how anybody could doubt the authenticity because everything rings true, whether you know anything about Kentucky or not, whether you know anything about the area or the lifestyle or not. Everything rings true. It's, there's nothing inauthentic about this at all. I mean, you're not a poser. You've lived it.
That's right. And my family has been there since, the Revolutionary War, some of them. But so we've been there a long time and have all sorts of experiences. And my father he's a collector of stories. And, of course, he was sort of in this himself. He felt very strongly about what had happened to the mountains. And so I had a head start there as well. The one thing that I failed to do when I was talking about the sheriff's murder cases, I don't think I made it clear how this part of the world is looked on in Kentucky in particular and some other areas. It's regarded, or was until the last 30 years or so, as one of the most dangerous parts of the world, a dangerous place to go, with a population that you couldn't, hard to deal with. And if you said the wrong thing, you're in trouble. And that, a lot of that is, that's just the way it is. Somebody asked me about if my sheriff in the sheriff's murder cases was like the sheriff in, Mayberry or Andy?
In the Andy Griffith Show?
Andy Griffith. I thought, well, you know, he wouldn't have lasted 2 minutes in that particular country. Just too dangerous and too rough. And there's just endless stories, and I think they keep them alive. There's one that comes to mind right at the moment. Happy Chandler, who was commissioner of baseball and governor of Kentucky, he decided one time that he would bring his friend Jack Dempsey.
The championship boxer.
Yeah, that he would bring him to Kentucky. And he brought him to the State House and had Dempsey say a few words. And Dempsey made the mistake of saying that he could whip any man in the house. He thought he was being funny.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, these two hillbillies got up in the back, and they had to tackle them. They were going to find out if he could whip anybody in the house. It's that kind of a, you don't insult anybody. And reading the newspapers was kind of amazing. World War One, there's a headline that said, this is the only newspaper in the area, "The Kaiser and his clan must be killed."
Uh-oh.
So that was their response to World War One, and occasionally saw reference to the Christmas killing lull. It's apparently a time when they stopped killing each other until Christmas was over. So.
Never mind objective journalism. Just get that headline out there. Right.
Right, yeah, but it's changed enormously, of course. It'd have to change, but and my own people, some of them, I'm not. This is Hatfield McCoy country, and the Turners were not. We're not very nice people there for a long time. So, in fact, in one county, we had a feud with, I think it was with the Howards, and after we ran them out of the county, we heard that one of them was on trial for murder in Kansas. So, most of the family loaded up on the train and went out to see him hung. So.
Did they pack picnic lunch? Or?
Sure they did. I don't know. That just astounds me, and yet I know it's the way it was. So.
Well, you've been a few more places in the world besides Kentucky. And these guys in The Foxes and the Hounds learned things on the outside that made the folks on the inside wonder who's for us and who's against us, you know, who's us and who's the other. So do you believe the old Thomas Wolfe writing that has since become a cliche that you can't go home again?
Yes, I'm afraid I do. I spend a lot of time up in there. I've still got the old farm at a place called Maytown in Floyd County. Oh, by the way, the county I grew up in, it led the nation in murders proportional to the population in 1921. And was only supplanted by Cook County, Illinois.
That's a good juxtaposition, rural and urban.
Yeah, that's a pretty well. But I need to clean that up a little bit, though. It's not murder; they're killings and they're murders.
Oh.
In that part of the country, like he needs killing.
Justifiable homicide.
Yeah. And so I don't know how many of those there would be. There were actual murders. Very few, I imagine. But I was. I've forgotten what you asked me now.
Well, you can't go home again.
I really can't. I'm looked on, well, it's complicated because I'm a Turner, and there are Turners everywhere. And so it's like they say, oh, you don't believe that, and just don't pay that much attention to my views, but I'm still a Turner, so I can draw a crowd up there pretty easily for a book signing. And I think my accent, they say my accent changes on depending on whether I've been up there or been down here. So, and I think that's probably true. And I don't fit, but I'm not sure I fit anywhere now. So,
well, here's hoping you draw a crowd when you speak at MTSU on November the 10th. The book is called The Foxes and the Hounds, Volume 1, Big Medicine River Days, a novel of Kentucky by Dr. Jack Justin Turner, who is a professor emeritus of international relations here at MTSU. Talking to us on the phone today. Thanks, Jack, for being with us.
Thank you.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Be sure and join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can download the podcast at mtsunews.com, and we're also available on iTunes.